And welcome back to All Things Urticaria, your UCare podcast. My name is Marcus, I'm the host of this show, and I want to start this particular episode with a big thank you to all of our loyal listeners. We just got the news that episodes of this podcast were downloaded 30,000 times. And by the feedback I get, email, social media, I have a sense that you really come to enjoy what we do here on All Things Urticaria. And you're going to love this episode because I have with me Philip Lee. Philip, hello.
Hi, Marcus. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on. Philip and I just had a wonderful meeting in Hong Kong. Thank you so much for hosting me there. Philip, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about where you are, what you do, how you fit into the whole UCare business?
Thank you, Marcus. The pleasure is all mine. So yes, we have just met and it was wonderful. And it really shows the importance of UCare bringing people together. So my name is Philip. I'm from Hong Kong. I'm actually a specialist in immunology and allergy. So getting into urticaria at the beginning was quite scary. There's lots of dermatologists in our part of the world. But now I know we also play our part. So I work in the University of Hong Kong. I'm also the Division Chief of Rheumatology and Clinical Immunology. And I lead the UCare and the ACARE Hong Kong representative centers here. And it really has been, we're a bit late to the game. We've joined for about 1 or 2 years, but we've really learned a lot. And I really feel that my sort of experience in this past 1 or 2 years is the importance of working together, like no matter it be urticaria, CSU, CIndU, or even angioedema, it really is a global problem, a global disease. Learning from each other, being able to network within UCare, having friends like you coming to visit, learning from each other, really makes a world of difference for our own patients and all things so internationally. So I really feel collaboration is the key. And this podcast, big congratulations, is again, a really great way for everyone to learn. And I really have been contributing to your downloads as well. And I will continue to download in the future. So thank you for having me again.
Very good. Look, Philip, I'm especially interested in your view on urticaria in Asia Pacific. Obviously, I'd love to talk a little bit about disparities, differences between our countries, our setups. You started saying that in Hong Kong and probably also your neighboring countries, it's dermatologists and allergists. That's not a big surprise. That is so in many countries. Do you see a difference in the approach that dermatologists and allergists have towards chronic urticaria?
So definitely. So I think I trained in the UK where also in the UK, both allergists, immunologists, in fact, three specialties, allergists, immunologists and dermatologists see urticaria sometimes separately. The problem is, as many people have said before me, that a lot of the times patients or even their doctors mistake urticaria as an allergy. They come expecting to find some sort of test or some sort of result to tell them what food or what environmental trigger to avoid, and that's why they see an allergist. And I think as an allergist, the first thing we try to exclude are, you know, the mast cell mediated reactive types of true allergy, not autoallergy, genuinely people are allergic to, because we are aware that especially the IgE mediator can be life-threatening, can be very severe, unlike most chronic urticaria patients. A dermatologist and their handle probably will be more interested in what the rash looks like. They will like to look at the photos, they'd like to look at the actual skin lesion, they would like to think of all the other differential diagnosis and probably put the allergy test a bit behind. I think there are pros and cons for both sorts of ways of doing it. And I think seeing how different people practice have given me a more combined approach. And I'm also very happy, for example, the international or regional guidelines for both urticaria and even angioedema do include a wide spectrum of specialists who are interested in urticaria, including allergists, including immunologists, and including dermatologists. I really think it is important. I think we speak a common limbo, the people who do work in this field. Again, I think we're a special type of party, unlike the rigid sort of grouping of the traditional specialties.
Yeah, it really does take all of us, no? I mean, when you think about numbers of urticaria patients who need help and the level that we're at, this is not something that one specialty can do and not something that one specialty should do. No, we need the experience, but also numbers of physicians to really provide good care for all of these many urticaria patients out there. Now, Philip, you're a motor of urticariology way beyond Hong Kong, very well connected in Asia Pacific and globally. I know you're working very closely with colleagues in India and so on. So I'm trying to understand how we are different in our settings when it comes to early diagnosis, correct diagnosis of chronic spontaneous urticaria, and obviously access to effective treatment. What is your take on this in your region of the world?
Yeah, definitely. So I was starting off saying that it's great to be, you know, united, having international collaboration. But to be honest, I share this view with many colleagues from this part of the world. We do get very jealous of people in the West when we hear your stories, when we hear your treatments, when we hear your response rates, your, oh my, waiting time to see a specialist is, you know, a few days, a few weeks. We get very jealous. I think there are many dimensions that we are jealous of. So, for example, it's like you mentioned, access. One of the things that I'm very passionate about is to find out the differences and how we can change or improve access to diagnosis, access to healthcare resources, access to treatment. So I think that makes a world of a difference. And beyond that, it's not just about the access or the medical side. It really is also the cultural differences. The patients who come to clinic, they react very differently. Their adherence to medications are very different. How they view certain things, how willing are they to spend, how willing are they to, you know, pay out no matter in time or effort to treat disease is very different. And more importantly, something that's also growing more and more of a concern to me is the differences in reimbursement, how patients get treatment. Because if you live in a system where you can get it fully reimbursed, the doctors and patients are, you know, much less restricted and they can go as far as the patient or the condition needs. But in many places, for example, in Hong Kong, unfortunately, many of the very, to be honest, very basic treatments, including just omalizumab now, which is now quite an old biologic, is still almost completely out of pocket. And there's also a big discrepancy between the costs of this biologic compared to other countries very nearby. So just across the border in mainland China, the price of the same drug made by the same company, probably imported, made in the same factory, can be many folds different, which again makes it very difficult for us and makes it very frustrating for physicians and patients. Why is it that purely based on where I live, it's so difficult to get the right treatment? And I think that is a lot of the common pains that colleagues like me face in this part of the world, especially.
Yeah, no, I understand that. That's very clear. Some people have heard me talking about my country, Germany, as urticaria heaven, where if you are a urticaria patient, you have access to very high level care and fully reimbursed treatment. And of course, this is not so in many other parts of the world. How specifically do you think does this affect how patients view the treatment? How does this affect your recommendation to you? Use treatment. What are the tricks that you have to, or tips that you have developed to bring as many patients to the treatment that they should have?
I think that's a very difficult question. We'll be here all evening or morning if we're going to speak about this completely. But it is so many levels and so many dimensions. So we're all aiming for urticaria heaven. We're all aiming for Germany-like status. But places in, for example, in my own city in Hong Kong, the problem is so much not only in the patients, but also their GPs, the entire medical community, as well as the specialists and even the so-called super specialists. We don't, for example, understand what we're treating for blood pressure, for rheumatoid arthritis. We're very sure there's targets. But unfortunately, in this part of the world, we're still not very open to things like patient-reported outcome measures. Simple things that everyone else in the world will use every day, like, for example, the care control test, even UAS7, the activity scores, or the dermatology, or the CU quality of life. These things, which we know are very useful in gauging treatments and success, patient treatment goals, gets the patients on board with you. To be honest, many years ago, weren't even translated in these languages. Yeah. Patients weren't able to use it. Luckily, I know I'm going to use my Cruise champion status now. You are also a big advocate of the app Cruise. Of course, hopefully it'll come to Hong Kong and in Chinese soon. But we need more of these tools so patients know that, oh, this is a target support. We should be aiming for something. But what happens now is these patients get symptoms and they just take an antihistamine now or then. They have no track. The GPs have no idea how they're doing. Patients could be suffering a lot. And Chinese patients, I would be very brave to say, are quite timid sometimes in the clinic room. They're very afraid of voicing out their, they think, very minor problems. Oh, like my urticaria is affecting my social life. They feel the doctor doesn't care, and therefore this is missed. And really affects these sort of environments where you are treating patients. So they sort of downplay it. If you look at their scores, oh, wow, they're really bad quality of life. Oh, the activity score is really high. And we spend literally just 3 or 4 minutes because of the huge patient load with these patients. And when we don't see the angioedema or the urticaria in front of us, we often do get, we have no idea how bad it is. And it's really bad. And the GPs, when they see this patient, they give the first generation antihistamines or steroid or tell the patients to go home. It's not life-threatening. They fail to understand the impact. And we know that poorly treated chronic urticaria is as worse as things like, you know, insulin-dependent diabetes, inflammatory conditions, but very less known. From the doctors and specialist point of view, they also aren't so aware of the consequences of, you know, the sleep disturbances, the quality of life, the impact it has in entire functioning. And also they don't understand that, you know, these drugs that we give just to sort get the patients out the door. So my in my city, many, many physicians would like to give a short course of steroids just to solve the problem. Because the doctors also are afraid of doctor shopping. So if I can't cure or treat this patient well, the patient won't come back.
Yeah.
So then I give a most effective treatment, a short dose of steroid, not thinking about the long-term sequelae, not understanding that it really isn't helping. So I think the disparities or the difficulties or the things that make it difficult for us to talk or to manage a patient is really multidimensional. Yeah. And I'm not even talking about the treatment access. So in fact, our center published a paper very recently. In Hong Kong, if you're very lucky and you're a civil servant or you work for the government, in fact, the medications is fully subsidized. So for example, something like omalizumab can be completely free. And if you exclude all other sorts of confounders, not looking at disease activity, not looking at the quality of life, et cetera, you just look at the reimbursement status, you are 9 times more likely to be able to be prescribed omalizumab just purely based on your reimbursement status alone. And unfortunately, and I've also joked that if you were to do like a tapering study or a dose tapering study, the best place to do it would be in my city, because patients pay out of pocket. You prescribe 300 milligrams of omalizumab every month, they will self-reduce, not without consulting you, because it costs so much.
Sure.
So these patients will be, you know, sparingly using their omalizumab every 6 weeks, every 8 weeks. But if you were reimbursed, they are very compliant. They will use the 300 milligrams every month. And you see the disease activity, the control, the quality of life does differ so much. And I think it's really sad. And I hope that someday we can fix that.
Yeah, no, and thank you for all of your action and activity around that. I know that your center and you have changed the situation already quite tremendously. And I know that very high on your agenda is the idea of educating general practitioners and aiding the access to expert care. You know, when I was in Hong Kong, I remember, and I was very impressed about your pathway project team there, have developed a mechanism that would guide patients depending their response to treatment or the severity and activity of their disease so that they would get access to expert care faster. I was very impressed by that and was happy to see that it's already showing really good results.
Thank you so much. Yes, we're very proud of what we call SHARP, our severe hives and angioedema referral pathway, because we feel that there are so many people being mistreated. Like I was saying, people were having chronic urticaria, visiting their GPs, always told us allergy. We have patients taking so much intermittent dose of steroids that they developed adrenal insufficiency, had osteoporosis due to steroid use. They were having really rubbish lives because they weren't eating this and eating that. And we're missing rarer causes or these differentials of chronic urticaria, HAE. So after SHARP, we managed to find our first Macau HAE patient. It was very lovely. But again, that patient was misdiagnosed as chronic urticaria, which again is something that we felt was a big problem. And hence, together with Macau, Hong Kong, and put together this referral pathway, hoping to capture these patients and just to improve the quality of care a bit more. The reason is we know there's international guidelines, but unfortunately, sometimes when countries are just a bit too far off, it's hard to get there immediately. And hence, we try to make it slightly more region specific, make it a bit more tangible so our colleagues can follow. Hopefully, next year we have a better version, and sooner or later, we won't need our own guidelines and we'll be able to reach international reputation.
No, absolutely. And being involved in the international urticaria and also angioedema HAE guideline, I welcome that very much, and I encourage the development of regional, local guideline versions, ideally, of course, based on the international guideline and bringing on board the regional context. And again, you're involved in several projects that do exactly that. No, make the guideline recommendations, the international guideline, accessible, applicable, and accessible to physicians, to colleagues in your country and the region. That is very important. No, we have to see these guidelines not as something that we do for ourselves as urticariologists, but for something that we do to help frontline doctors understand the disease better and take the right action. And that action can be very different in different countries depending on the setting, the availability. And so it is important to cater to the physician population we want to help. Thank you. Thank you for doing that.
Really agree. Thank you, Marcus, for leading us all the way.
Looking at the time, Philip, it's unbelievable. I think we're already towards the end. I had one other question, actually two other questions. I'll save the million dollar, and I don't mean Hong Kong dollar, I mean real US dollar question to the end. I do want to ask you about the level of knowledge, or how this is patients now, talking about patients, the level of knowledge that patients have of their disease, because only recently it became very clear to us here in Germany that what patients think about their disease, including why they have the disease or where it comes from and what it will do to them, is very different than what we know as urticaria specialists. And I wonder what this is like in Hong Kong and in the region. How do patients with chronic spontaneous urticaria interpret their disease? How do they see this come about? And what do they think it means to have this disease?
That's a really great question. So I used to practice in the UK, and I can say it really is very different. The cultural context is very different. Yeah. So I always joke about this. So when I was in the UK practicing allergy, I thought I saw most of the common allergies. Then coming back to Hong Kong, for some reason, all my referral letters were saying, oh, this patient is allergic to beef, goose, duck. And I was like, really weird. These food allergies are very uncommon. But why is every patient coming through my door telling me they're allergic to these specific food groups? So in Chinese medicine, there are certain foods which change your balance. And the sort of Chinese sort of non-Western medicine way to interpret rashes and recurrent rashes is the imbalance. And therefore, they also will mix this concept with allergy. So they think, oh, I'm taking too much of this food. And they come to me, not because of chronic urticaria. They come to me for, oh, I think I'm allergic to these few foods. So it's really interesting, and it doesn't help that antihistamines are called anti-allergic medications in Chinese. So I take, my doctor gave me anti-allergic medications. It really helps. It must be an allergy. It makes it really difficult. And I must say, when I try to explain to my fellow colleagues, my residents, my trainees, tell them what is autoallergy, what is autoimmunity issue, they have difficulty understanding, let alone explaining to patients. So sometimes I just make it easier. I just tell them this is a dysregulation of your immune system. It is all in imbalance. But unfortunately, it really isn't much to do with what you eat. It is just an internal imbalance. Okay. Luckily, patients' imbalance will improve over time. 5 or 6 years, you might, a lot of people get better, but we need to make you well during that time. The second thing, cultural difference is they always think that Western medications are toxic. All drugs are toxic. Therefore, I cannot take drugs. So therefore, they don't like to take the antihistamines so much. But then I tell them, if you don't take good medications, it'll progress into angioedema, it'll get even worse, you'll be using steroids, it's like even more toxic. So you might use these very safe medications will be much better in the long term. So these are tips or sort of phrases that I use. I never needed to use in when I practiced in the West, but you really have to understand the sort of concepts of the patients working there. And I feel this is where, again, going back to your point about regional guidelines or regional practices, we can share, because for example, the Japanese, the Koreans, share more similar cultural backgrounds to us, and these things pertain. So I guess having these sort of smaller groups or sort of friends that can talk about this, we learn from each other, and I think it's really interesting, and I think it's the way forward. Yeah.
Super. Thanks for sharing. That was very interesting, and I believe very important for our listeners from your region to learn from each other and how to make use of misconceptions, not to, let's stay on the positive side, to make use of them, to make patients understand that what we want for them is the best for them, and to have them embrace the recommendations that we
and
have
not
for
just
them.
The patients, colleagues also need
colleagues
a
also
including ourselves. Yes, definitely.
Oh, very true. Look, Philip, $1 million question. And I'm happy to double that if you have a good idea on how to spend the first $1 million. It cannot be on making access to drugs free, but it must be on improving the care for patients with urticaria in your region. Let's say Hong Kong, neighboring countries. How would you spend that money?
So 1 million or 2 million, even US, would probably not be enough. But if I did have a bit more money, one of the priorities which I really hope we can drive as an international community, although not making free access to medication, that is obviously impractical. But I want to make it more equal, not equality, but equity. I really feel that we need to get the resources and distribute it more evenly. At the moment, in parts of the world like Hong Kong, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. In the sense that the very well-off or the more privileged patients can get access to specialist care, they can afford the medications, the doctors are the specialists who look after them, and they seem to get better and better. But we do pull away from patients who do not have access. They aren't so lucky to find a doctor who knows what is the diagnosis, can't get them on the medications, and the medications get more and more expensive. So I think another way to look about it is we shouldn't be giving the same opportunity to everyone. It should be based on their needs. So I really am interested in finding ways which you can identify patients who are most at need. There are PRMs, patient reported outcome measures, but are there more objective measures? Something which I can take a blood test or I can screen very easily to know this is the patient I need to really look out for. This person needs a bit more attention that I need to do. Things like the BAT or something. We're getting there, but a bit too slow. And I must say, compared to other rheumatological or immunological sort of diseases that I look after, CSU is just a little bit behind. And I hope that we can have more objective things. And we can convince our governments that this is the way to spend the money effectively. Quality of life, qualities are worth something. And it's not just, you know, a happy or sad patient. They're productive. They bring sort of productivity to the community. Your money is well spent. And I hope we can put more research and more interest into this field, especially in our region. So I'm looking forward to your $2 million check, Marcus. Thank you.
Deal. Love it. let's work on this together, Philip. Excellent. And I know from watching the speed of you and your team that patience is not your strong suit. We share that. We want things to happen fast. I think coming back to the very beginning of our conversation, this will only happen when we do it together, when we join forces, when we really support each other and become a strong network to help with these efforts in your region and globally. Thank you so much, Philip. This was fun as always when I talked to you, and enlightening for our listeners. Thank you.
Thank you so much. My pleasure. Looking forward to working more together to the years to come. Thank you.
Folks, this was all the time we had for this wonderful episode with Philip Lee from Hong Kong. Thanks again to him, and thanks to you for listening to the very end of this episode. Happy to see you stick around. Happy to see you come back for the next episode to come. And if you haven't had a chance to listen to all of the previous episodes, well, they are available everywhere where you get your podcasts. And if you have an idea a suggestion, a question that you want us to address in All Things Urticaria, by all means, let me know, and I'll make sure we talk about this in one of our future episodes of this podcast. Now, we will put a lot of what we talked about, some background material, into the show notes, so go check that out, click the links, get more information, going a bit deeper than we had the time to do so today. I had a lot of fun, Philip, again, thank you very much. And with that, folks, stay healthy and tune back in for our next episode of All Things Urticaria. Bye-bye.